Well, a very good evening and a very warm welcome one and all to Dr. Rock's radio show here on peoplesinternetradio.com, where we are seeking solutions. In a few minutes, hopefully, if all goes according to plan, we'll be joined by Annie Day. She was on the show 2 or 3 weeks ago talking to us about kinesiology, Reiki, reflexology, detoxing and the correct use of water, all of which I've experienced over the years whilst enjoying having Annie as one of my complementary therapy team. I'm now almost entirely kept on the road by complementary therapies and very rarely find myself in the hands of the NHS. Tonight we're planning on talking, because Annie's always developing her skills, and one of the things she was trained in recently is the use of NLP, or Neuro-Linguistic Programming, for health, which I found quite an interesting idea. I'm only just playing with that end of her skills myself, and do seem, I must admit, to be to get some results from it. So that'll be the first half of the show. And Annie's also coming close now to the end of a PhD in sexual healing, which is apparently an extremely rare thing to be doing, but also extremely necessary. And for one reason or another, that is something about which I know absolutely nothing. So it should be interesting to see how that conversation goes. But I know that I can rely on Annie to come up with plenty of interesting data. So hopefully you're all ready for that. I'm going to play another 5 or 6 minutes of tunes, because it's been a pretty hairy technical intro to this show. And it takes me a while to slip out of tech mode and into performance mode. But whilst I do that, I'll get Annie on the line. And hopefully in, looks like 5 or 6 minutes or so, we'll be back with you. In the meantime, everything seems to be working. Glad to see you're all out there. And I'll be back with you in a few minutes. Here's Best Days from Land of the Giants. That was Horace X and Skin, the remix from their Strategy album. And before that, as I said, Best Days by Land of the Giants. You're back live with Dr. Rock's radio show, still out here and running on peoplesinternetradio.com. And I'm joined on the line by Annie Day. Can you hear me okay, Annie?
I can indeed. Thank you. I'm really delighted to be speaking with everybody tonight. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you very much for rejoining us on the show. We're looking forward very much to a second session with you. And tonight we're going to cover different things from last time. So shall we kick off with the NLP? Can you first of all give us a bit of summary as to what NLP is and what it's used for?
Okay. So NLP stands for, it's the abbreviated form of Neuro-Linguistic Programming, which began its life in the 1970s when a professor from the University of California called John Grinder teamed up with another undergraduate called Richard Bandler. They both had a real fascination with human excellence, which charted a path for them to model behaviour patterns of selected masters of excellence. So modelling is one of the core activities in NLP, and it's the process of replicating the language structure and behavioural patterns of individuals who are excellent at a given activity. So Grinder and Bandler started their NLP quest by modelling three people, Fritz Perls, Virginia Satir and Milton Erickson, all of whom were linguistic people of excellence, shall we say. These geniuses were outstanding professionals of change facilitation working in the area of therapy. All three therapists, Perls, Satir and Erickson's, all of these, Erickson performed their magic from a perspective of unconscious excellence. Grinder and Bandler absorbed the patterning inherent in the geniuses' work and then provided what we would know now as a description of NLP. Then what they did was they coded the results of their work in language-based models using these patterns of descriptive vocabulary. And using the NLP modelling, Grinder and Bandler replicated the skills of the three geniuses, and so NLP was born. Their enthusiasm is in part captured in an introduction in the book called Structure of Magic. The training courses Bandler and Grinder conducted proved that NLP models were transferable to others, meaning that learners could use the NLP models successfully in their own work. So that's kind of the background to it.
So what we're talking about, these guys were all therapists anyway, were they?
Yeah.
Okay, and what they appear to have been doing is looking at people who were doing things well and then somehow codifying it so that these people's performance could be easily replicated by others. Is that right?
Absolutely. In a nutshell, that's exactly what they did. And once they realised that they could learn from geniuses of excellence, which is what they call them, and this model of magic, people who are really at the top of their game, then it became very apparent that this was a structure that could be taught to other people, that it wasn't just Bandler and Grinder that were capable of doing this, that everybody could do this. So let's say that I wanted to teach, you wanted to learn how to be a great belly dancer. I know.
Yeah, okay, then let's say that.
I'm really good as a belly dancing teacher, so what you would do is you would watch my warm-up exercises, you would watch how I move my body, you would look at the kind of music I use, and literally you'd try as much as possible to model my behaviour of excellence. You'd also watch me doing cool down, so you'd be actually watching, but there would be an element of you demonstrating simultaneously with me, so basically really copying everything that I was doing so that you can replicate that behaviour and have that genius on board yourself. So that's a really extreme example, I know, but that's kind of what Bandler and Grinder did. They actually looked at these geniuses and said, that's definitely how I want to be modelling this great behaviour. And from there, they went on to teach other people. So it was in the 1970s, really, that they, perfected their art, shall we say.
So we're talking about effectively actually using your sense, using your five senses to see, hear and feel what's going on and then try and replicate it. Where does the language part of it come in?
Because basically, what we think with NLP, it's that you can use it for personal development, releasing fears and phobias, and for helping you to achieve your maximum personal and professional potential. Basically, NLP is the practice of understanding how we organise our thinking, feelings, language and behaviour to produce the results and behaviours that we do. NLP is a way of providing us with a methodology, if you like, to model outstanding performances achieved by leaders in their field. But a key element of NLP is that we form our own unique internal mental maps of the world as a product of the way we filter, interpret and perceive information that is absorbed through our five senses from the world around us. So the NeuroBlitz is each individual can establish their own unique mental filtering system for processing the many millions of pieces of data that have been stored through our senses in each second. And our first mental map of the world consists of internal images, sounds, tactile awareness, internal sensation, tastes and smells that are all formed as a result of our neurological filtering process. The linguistic part, we could assign our own personal meaning to the information being received basically from the outside world, and it's how we receive it. We then form our second mental map by assigning language to those internal images, okay, sounds, feelings, tastes and smells, which form our everyday consciousness. So the second mental map you could call a linguistic map, and the programming, this is a behavioural response that occurs as a result of our complex neurological filtering processes, and the subsequent linguistic match, which is then formed. So it's really the neuro bit and the linguistic and the programming and all an integral part of you reaching that perfect state of being, whether it's a behaviour pattern, whether it's the way that you want to speak, whatever it is, it's using every single bit of your human capacity to bring about the best quality possible, if that makes
sense. Okay, that sounds pretty interesting to me, because it brings to mind a lot of things that we talk about a lot on this radio station, and it might be regarded as the other way round of doing things, really, which is that the images we see and what we see in the world around us and what we're trained to choose to see in the world around us is very much circumscribed by the media and by a million other things, yeah. And that a lot of the words we've realized are actually used to kind of program in the responses that that yeah. come as a result with the way we see the world. And the result is apparently a whole world full of sleeping people that don't know how to eat properly, don't know how to drink water, don't know how to turn the bloody television off, don't know how to not buy newspapers, all that kind of stuff. So what we appear to be talking about here is addressing some of these difficulties and turning it around so that what you're, so that A, you witness stuff, you witness different stuff, i.e. with our senses, we notice different stuff, we filter it differently. And then the language part of it is to do with the way we relate to it and get it into our own systems. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it. Yeah, absolutely. So really, it's an excellent way of reaching your, what shall I say, optimum potential as a human being. Because just by using all of that and having the knowledge to change the words that we're saying so that we're not giving our, you know, we're not giving our the cells in our body any negativity. So it's literally a way of always looking at the optimistic side of life and really engaging with very positive emotions so that you're not kind of firing on one cylinder. So literally you're reaching your full potential, and also you're able to express your full potential. It's very little use to anybody, is it, to be to have really fantastic behavior patterns and then not to be able to express it. It's kind of a pointless exercise. So the neuro-linguistic programming helps you to reach your full potential, but also to always see the cup as being, you know, overflowing rather than half empty all the time. So it's a really positive step in getting rid of any unhelpful thoughts. And, you know, I appreciate that you and I have both read Dr. Bruce Lipton's book, The Biology of Belief. Uh-huh. And, you know, what he talks about is literally every negative thought that we think, every cell in our body actually hears and acts upon. So NLP, for me, particularly personally and professionally, has been a way of ensuring that I stay on the straight and narrow and I make sure I'm joyful and energetic and optimistic all the time, and that it's a rarity that I ever succumb to negativity.
Yeah, I'd noticed that.
Thank you, Doug.
So when we're talking about, this is another thing that springs to mind here, when we're talking about assigning language to things, like, as you say, every negative thought we have affects our entire system. And presumably the same is true of every positive thought. When we're talking about assigning language, we've been talking about affirmation for years, haven't we? Is this basically the science of affirmation, but with bells and whistles?
Oh, most definitely. And that leads me beautifully on to cutting edge NLP technique that's literally only just come through within the last 12 months. And I've been really honoured and absolutely delighted that my teacher, probably about 4 weeks ago, was in London with Paul McKenna and the two Rudrick brothers that actually brought this system through. And it's called Havening. So you can use Havening for getting rid of PTSD. Sorry, I'll explain that. Post-traumatic stress syndrome, for getting rid of fears and phobias. You can do something called event havening. So let's say that you've got an interview tomorrow or a really important meeting. You can literally, while you're doing the havening movements, which are physical movements, you can actually see the most positive outcome for that meeting or whatever it is. So that when you actually get into the meeting, it's a done deal. That energy is already there, that there's a really hugely positive outcome coming out of it. And then the last but not least is the affirmation havening. So what you would do is you would select your affirmations and then you would start by hugging yourself. So if you imagine that you're now hugging yourself, and then you're gently moving your hands down your body, down your arms until you get to the wrists. And then what you'd do is you'd stroke one hand over the other. The next move of the havening is you put your fingertips underneath your eyes and move them down to your chin. And then you move your fingertips from either side of your nose towards your ears. So we'll give it a shot now. So one that I've been using for quite a while that's had brilliant results is I'm a magnet for prosperity and abundance. So literally, I'm going to do it now. So I realize this is not visual. So I'll talk you through what I'm doing. So as I do, as I say, I'm a magnet for prosperity and abundance, I'm going to start by hugging myself and then gently stroking my hands down my arms to my wrists. I'm a magnet for prosperity and abundance. Then the next time I do it, I'm doing it over my hands as I stroke both of my hands. I'm a magnet for prosperity and abundance. Then the next one moves from under my eyes to my chin. I'm a magnet for prosperity and abundance. And then again, either side of my nose to my ears, I'm a magnet for prosperity and abundance. And I have to say, for me personally and professionally, this has been life-changing in the most brilliant way. And I was really lucky. I've been trying to get onto the lovely Tony Burgess's NLP course for 7 years now. They've offered it me 3 times free of charge because they were desperate also for me to be using it with my patients and for me to reach my full potential. And for various reasons over the last 7 years, it's not been proper, you know, we've not been able to do that. And then in May last year, I actually got on the course. And the day that I arrived at the course venue, my teacher came out and said, "We're just putting the red carpet out for you, Annie Day." And literally had got a piece of red carpet for me. And then said, "I've got some really interesting information for you. I know now why we've not been able to, or despite our best efforts, we've not been able to get you onto this NLP course for the last 7 years. I've been doing a technique called Havening for the last 12 months from a book that I picked up. And I've been using it for 12 months on my family and friends. And this weekend, this last weekend, I did all day Friday, all day Saturday, all day Sunday on the Havening technique, and I'm going to be teaching you this morning." I was like, wow. And when he started to tell me what it could do, I was really, really just blown away by it. I started in November. I'm a kinesiologist, and I tested up which affirmations would be the best for me on a daily basis. And I got, "My unique talents and abilities are always in great demand. My wealth comes from expected and unexpected sources." And I got, "Right now, enormous wealth and power are available to me. I choose to feel worthy and deserving." And literally, I'd done it for 3 days when my lovely friend Deborah phoned me and said, "What are you doing? What are you doing at the beginning of November?" And I said, "I don't know." And she said, "Go and have a look at your diary and then I'll tell you why." So she came back. I came back and said, "I've only got 2 teaching engagements at the moment." She said, "How would you like to go out to Antalya, first class 5-star flights and 5-star accommodation?" And I said, "What do I need to do to sing for my supper?" And she said, "Well, I've just had a call from someone who's asked me, do I know anybody who can talk convincingly and coherently about sexual and spiritual healing?" So she said, I said, "Oh, Annie Day's doing a master's degree in it. And I think she's in her final year." And then he said, "Oh, brilliant. Well, can you invite her to come to Antalya for the World Symposium on Complementary Medicine and be one of our speakers?" "Oh, and while I've got you on the phone, Deborah, we've also got a skill shortage with, we need someone who can teach belly dancing and also that they can explain to us as they demonstrate it why it's so good for stimulating kundalini sexual and spiritual energy." And she went, "That'd be the same person then." And the only things I'd done differently at that point was those 3 affirmations. So I know that that was what made that manifest, if you like, for me, which was absolutely extraordinarily good.
Well, having heard of them from you and having received my little the attachment on the email recently, I've been playing that game as well.
And, yeah.
I'm having some interesting experience as well. It does seem that that things start appearing a lot more easily. But it makes a lot of sense to me because I feel that we're deeply programmed in all sorts of ways by our environment, even by the very language we use. In fact, even the word language means kind of tied by the tongue, really. Yeah. And to start working the other way seems to make loads of sense. Do you have any idea why it is that those particular movements work? Is there anything about the meridians, or what is it, do you think?
Well, the Rudrick brothers, when they first brought this through, what they did was they experimented for about 20 years in total, bringing this to fruition. But what they did was they experimented with stroking the chakra points. They started with, what did they do then? Then they did all the meridian lines. Then they tried stroking the hair, thinking that a soothing movement would be the way to lock it in. And it was literally getting people who were willing to be experimented on, putting electrodes on them, and then monitoring their brain activity and whether this was actually locking it in or doing the opposite and repelling it. And what they discovered was these three moves, for whatever reason, which they can't really explain other than they tried just about every move that you can think of. They tried stroking the feet. They tried all sorts, literally every kind of, what shall I say, complementary medicine way of working. They explored all of that. And these three moves, I think that they're very comforting. The fact that you're hugging yourself, there's something really lovely about that. And, you know, I know from working in a hospice and working in a women's refuge that quite often the receptors in our hands are very, very sensitive. So if someone touches our hands, which we're going over all the meridians in hand reflexology when we're stroking our hand, and again on our face in heart, in face reflexology, the move from underneath your eyes to your chin is actually stroking your lung meridian, which in Chinese medicine we believe is about loss and grief issues. So if it's stroking that, it's literally soothing and going there. Then again, in face reflexology, if we take our fingers from our nose, which is represented as the heart in face reflexology, to our ears, again, we're soothing our heart. So I think there's something quite potent about the face reflexology reflecting the heart and the lungs. And then the other ways, it's literally hugging yourself and then stroking one hand over the other. There's something very primal and very soothing and nurturing about that, I think.
And again, it seems to me what comes to mind listening to you say all of that is that one of the main aims, it seems to me, of the system that we're actually living under at the moment is to keep us stressed out, frightened and loveless.
Oh, absolutely. And this is the opposite of that. It's definitely a really wonderful way to embed positive affirmational messages into your brain. But again, using Dr. Lipton's analogy, you know, it's actually locking those at a cellular level, which I think is just brilliant, when it's such an easy way, an easy thing to do. You know, it's not complex. You don't have to hold convoluted acupuncture points. You don't have to do anything unnecessary. You literally say your affirmation, which needs to be set in the positive, in the present moment. And yeah, it needs to be set in this moment right now. So it's no good saying I'm going to do this tomorrow, because we all know that tomorrow never comes. We need to be concentrating all our affirmations onto the present moment, and finding a way of actually locking them in, I think, is wonderful. And I remember, you know, in 1998, my acupuncturist told me to look in a mirror and say, I'm a sexy, beautiful, successful woman. And inside I was doing, and doing all this kind of monkey impression. And I just wasn't allowing that affirmation in because I didn't believe it. And I think that had I known about this technique then, which clearly wasn't around then, it is literally up to the moment, I think I'd have been able to use them really, really well then. And actually learning them now, it's helped people who are new to using affirmations to manifest their dreams into reality. It's really been a great way of starting off the right way straight away without having to go through all the, what shall I say, experimental stages of going, well, what really locks this in for me? What am I denying? What am I not allowing in? So literally for the patients that have come to me since last May, I've had the most fantastic benefits for people, because literally it's individual specific to you, but also it really gets rid of any issues of lack of self-worth, any issues of self-criticism, and just blasts its way through any self-imposed belief systems about you not being worthy to receive something. So for me, this has been one of the most extraordinary systems that I've ever come across, really.
I love the fact that the guys that kind of discovered it did a mixture of what was basically 20 years of blind investigation, but using like brain scanning stuff and autonomic responses to find out how well it was working. I love the mixture of the high tech and the low tech there.
Yeah, it's a really good way of doing it, isn't it? And I was impressed that they were therapists as well. So they were not only NLP practitioners, but they did all sorts of, you know, physical things like massage and chiropractic treatment. So they've got a really good understanding of Chinese traditional medicine, as well as all the other stuff. And I just think it's an absolutely awesome combination.
And I guess, I mean, in my opinion, there's always going to be somebody for whom these things don't work. But it's a useful thing to add to the armory, as it were, of all the other. It does seem that the Chinese stuff's really coming to the fore, isn't it? I mean,
absolutely. I mean, I've been a great advocate since 1998 of acupuncture, particularly. And then in kinesiology, we hold all the traditional Chinese medicine points. And I'd fractured my spine in 1998. I fractured my coccyx and my pelvis in a PE accident in a school. And literally 6 months after the accident, the NHS still couldn't help me. And it was a really pivotal turning point for me because I was 44 at the time. And my GP said, oh, well, there's nothing else we can do for you now. So I suggest that you come to our pain management clinics. And I had a bit of a meltdown and went, this can't be fucking right. My life can't be over at 44. And I was having this tantrum and crying outside the doctor's. Just completely, just so unhappy that at the time I couldn't walk. I was walking like a sumo wrestler with a nappy on.
I remember you telling us about this. It is amazing that you can get kind of get fractures and stuff fixed, really. And that actually shows that, because you were telling us about that when we were talking about the kinesiology. Yeah. And it's one of the things it does for me is it shows without a doubt the kind of power of these techniques under certain circumstances, and at least with some people.
Yes.
And I mean, all of the main methods that have been used to sort me out, because although I hadn't broken anything, I was, when I came to Wales, I was pretty close to being crippled, really, with knackered joints. I couldn't use my arms properly. I had a sore back. It was very difficult for me to do anything for any length of time without having to lie down for two or three days.
Yeah.
And the basic methods that have pulled me around have been kinesiology, shiatsu, and the Bowen technique, all of which, and of course the ceremonies, all of which are basically based around these Chinese meridians.
Yeah, absolutely.
Another thing is that it reminds me of a bunch of movements, the name for which I can't remember, but I remember our mutual friend Anna, when we were doing kinesiology together, she gave me an encapsulated sheet with a load of movements.
With the energy toning movements on.
That's the energy toning movements, that's right. And one of those involved hugging yourself and moving your hands down your arms.
Yeah. That's right, and that was for the heart chakra.
Yeah, and there were a whole load more of them, and
there's one for bladder and kidneys, there's one for liver and gallbladders, there's the heart, there's the lungs. Basically, there's an energy toning factor, energy toning movement for every single major organ in the body. And, you know, what they do is it activates and strengthens the energy pathways.
Because they were amazing. I did those for a while. Hopefully, when we get to unpack our various boxes at some point in the future, I'll find that sheet again, because I did find it a very good way of starting the day.
Yeah.
And again, there's all this kind of conditioning that's being visited upon us, and I guess again this is just a way of kind of working around it. Also, I remember I came across some people, I've never had time to look at it properly, I call it face tapping, I don't know what its proper name is.
Emotional freedom technique, possibly.
That's the one. Yeah, indeed. And that also is to do with touching points on the face, and some of those are the points that you've mentioned as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So in a way, this stuff has been around in different forms for a while, hasn't it?
Yeah, and I think what they've done beautifully is to, as you've already said, they've got very complex information from all sorts of different strategies, but particularly from Chinese medicine, and brought it together to make this very coherent whole. And again, the underlying energies, the NLP stuff as well, you know, the importance of NLP is making sure that your words count.
Oh, that really hits home, because, you know, it's sort of like a Freeman word game, really, where people try to avoid using words like person and stuff, because we now know that those words mean something different from what we've been told.
Yeah.
And so all of us tend to be pretty careful about what words we use for that reason. But yeah. Also there's this business of when you listen to the weather forecast, they're constantly telling you there's a threat of this and a danger of that. And when we're talking about difficult situations, we have many of us anyway, if you listen to people, we have a tendency automatically to resort to the words of war, you know, yes. to combating something or fighting something or defeating something. And yeah. this is what I mean when I say that our whole approach to life is being conditioned around us. And that suggests to me that it's important in all sorts of ways to start thinking about how we say things and what we're saying.
Yeah. And one of the classic ones that I've known about for a number of years, because we did a mini NLP course when I was still a special needs teacher in a primary school, was we had this lady in, and she started my interest in NLP, if I'm honest about it. But she said the reason that children particularly, but also adults, don't respond to a negative is our minds cannot process a negative. So if you say, don't run down the corridor, the child hears run down the corridor. If you say, don't think about the purple banana being eaten by the yellow monkey, you have to think about it to not think about it.
Mm-hmm.
So literally in NLP, we're taught to avoid saying don't. Don't, because literally, if you say that negative, what precedes that means that you've given it more energy than it deserves, basically. So you, by saying, don't run down the corridor, means that that's the very thing the person will do, because our brains cannot process negatives.
And of course, when
I heard that, I was like, wow, that makes so much sense.
That is amazing, isn't it? Because we also know from considerable historical experience that prohibition doesn't work.
Exactly, darling.
and yet the whole legislative system is based on continuous and ever extending prohibition.
Yep, that's the one.
So effectively, I mean, you could make an argument for suggesting that we're actually being fined and locked up and all of that, for, although they're telling us not to do it, by doing that they're actually encouraging us to do it.
They're going, come on, bring it on, just yeah.
Very profitable business.
Absolutely.
So how much time did you have to put into learning the NLP? Was it a major project, or was it just a weekend?
No, it wasn't. It was a major project. It was about 3 weeks in total. We started at 9 o'clock every morning and finished at 6:30 every night. And because I'm a little sweetheart and I know what I'm doing and I've been a therapist for a long time, I'd arranged that during that course I would set my intention that every night I'd have one patient in and I'd be able to use some of what I'd learnt during the day, because I'm an experiential learner, as most of us are. It's not enough for me to hear it. It's not enough for me to see it. It's not enough for me to read it. I have to actually get on and do it, you know, as an activist. So for me, that was brilliant, because it really locked it in and really reinforced that information. But then there were 32 CDs that came with the course, and then a huge manual. So every day you would listen to another CD and you would write your answers to it, and then you'd do workbooks and you'd do work share. But throughout the course, you were working on all the other students as well as our teachers, so that they were very aware right from the start whether you'd not understood something and whether you had understood something. And actually, their way of, their way of praising people is so Oh, I can't tell you how lovely it is. It just really made you want to go on and do even more. You know, that the language that they're using, clearly they've been doing NLP for a very long time, something like in excess of 20 years. And, you know, the way that they praised us just really motivated you and made you want to learn more. And because they're so passionate about it and so excited by what they're teaching, I think that's quite quite contagious. And I know that that's what makes me a really good teacher, that I fire my students up with my own passion.
And I bet they have had a tendency to praise rather than criticise, did they?
Oh, absolutely. And if they did need to give anybody criticism, it was set in such a way that they'd say, right, you did that really well, but what I would suggest is, if you want to get even better results, how about, think about doing blah, blah. So it was never actually, it never felt like a criticism. It always felt like a really good way of developing the art of NLP or developing the art of havening. So the way that they put it across was never ever critical at all.
And that, again, that's another important point when it comes to thinking about what we're saying, isn't it? Because some of the best people I've worked with over the last 15, 20 years or so, I've noticed that they just don't. They might every now and then on the QT have a bit of a moan in the kitchen over a glass of wine about somebody, but it's very rare and it'll never happen to people's faces. They always kind of draw the best out of people by drawing the best out of people. And I mean, we know, don't we? We know. I mean, I'm fairly hard skinned, but I still don't take criticism well because it makes me feel inadequate. There's a lot of people around the place who are a lot less thick skinned than I am. And I would guess that even a hint of criticism probably puts them off entirely.
Yeah.
So being encouraging with people is one of the most, I think one of the most important ways that we can learn to live together and start reducing the amount of trouble we're having.
Yeah, I'm sure. And, you know, if we love ourselves unconditionally, it's so much easier to love everybody else unconditionally. And I'm not saying it's the easiest thing to do because of all the reasons that you've described. And, you know, throughout our childhoods and our teenage years, we're very affected by what people in authority say to us and about us. You know, literally as a child, we absorb everything that we're told. So if you're not getting positive messages and you're told that you're no good, or you're told that you're not worthy, or you're not valued and loved, then you really believe it because you've got no yardstick and no experience or knowledge to judge it against. So everything an adult in authority tells you is taken on board, and I think it's quite often years later when people go, actually, just because that dance teacher in the fourth year told me I was crap at dancing doesn't mean to say as an adult now that that's true. And, you know, I think that there's a lot of that in the way that we develop as young adults, basically.
That absolutely happened to me. We were given a bit of an art project, and I used to really enjoy art. This was at what we used to call junior school. I've no idea what they're called now. And we were given a job to design, I think it was a trademark or something, and we were told to keep it simple because people need to be able to remember trademarks, which in itself was an interesting bit of programming, I thought. But what I came up with was a really tidy, colourful little visual joke for this kind of car recovery company I was making one for. Yeah. And the guy did come up to me and he said, I told you to keep it simple. I don't want to see all of these lines and all this colour and stuff. I didn't paint. I didn't do any more artwork at all until I was about 36, 37. And you've seen my artwork. It's extremely detailed and extremely colourful. So he really put me off for the best part of 30 years. And, you know, that's just one that I remember. I can't imagine how many other smaller things, because that one obviously was quite big for me because I remember it. But I bet it was happening all the time. Actually, I just see Mahatma Coates put a link in the chat box, which he's put haha, no yoga, Reiki or Tai Chi. And he's put a link to a local National Republic of Ireland news thing which says yoga will endanger your soul, Donegal priest warns parishioners.
Class.
So
blessing.
So what sort of things did your willing victims find you practicing on them in the early weeks or the early parts of your NLP? What was the first thing you started doing with them?
Getting rid of unhelpful thoughts, basically helping people to get out their own way.
And
shall I kind of explain that? So sometimes if people had had a traumatic event in their lives and it was still lingering about and they were still, it was still affecting their behaviour and what they were, the progress that they were making, then literally you could replay the event and the person that was abusing you or shouting at you, you imagine that they've got a Mickey Mouse voice and they've just taken a swallow of helium gas and they're talking like this in a very fast voice and it takes all the power out of it. Or you imagine that the person who's been traumatised has got a remote control and literally they can fast forward it, they can freeze frame it, they can make it the event happen behind a screen, they can view it from above in a helicopter, they can view it from a long distance away and then look at it and look at it as if it was an actor on a stage or, you know, there's all sorts of strategies so that that person could look at things and look at what was really happening, acknowledge it and then be able to release this, which we're not able to do when we're getting very unhelpful memories or very unhelpful, you know, flashbacks, for instance. So some of the stuff that I help people with was literally replaying events from different perspectives for maximising their learning and development. And also this helped to strengthen their sense of identity and self-worth and help them to become more outcome and solution focused. And again, getting out of your own way more easily. It helps you to release any phobias, traumas or other unhelpful baggage. And the NLP is just brilliant at giving you the skills to have more purposeful, helpful conversations by harnessing the power of effective language.
Yeah.
So literally saying what you mean, meaning what you say.
Yeah, yeah. I have become aware through several people that have taught me that most of the perimeters that we have around ourselves are actually self-imposed. They might be as a result of what somebody else has said to us, yeah, but they are imposed by us. So readdressing these experiences has got to be a good thing to do.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the ones that I remember really vividly, without going into too many details, obviously for client confidentiality, but I had a guy here within my first week of learning NLP in the Havening. And he'd got post-traumatic stress syndrome from 20 years ago when he was in the armed forces, he was in the SAS. And he saw things, quite frankly, that no human being should ever see. And he said, I'm coming to you because my wife trusts you and she says that you'll be able to help me. And literally, I'd learnt to do the Havening that day. And one of the things we'd learnt was how to help people with incredible PTSD. And what we were taught to do was to get the person to think of one, if there were loads, which in his case, there were millions of examples, and he just gave me half a dozen really quickly. And the reason he came to me was every time a motorbike backfired or there was that particular noise, he'd run for cover and he'd be under the table because he would be back in that war zone again. And so the night that he came to see me, it was all still fresh in my mind. And I said, so if you were going to score this, you know, just find one typical event from that time period that exemplifies what you were experiencing at the time. And then I would like you to score it between 0 and 10, 10 being maximum stress, 0 mean bugger all. And he went 10,000. I was like, oh, right. So we did the first session of Havening when basically you send the, while you're stroking the person from their, again, hugging them down to their wrist, then their hands, then under their eyes, both ways. While you're doing that, you send their mind off to do little tasks, which are utilised in different parts of the brain. And while you're doing that, you're still stroking them. And what that does is, to lock in any memory, you've got to have one molecule of calcium and one molecule of, what's the other one called? Calcium and, I can't think what the other one is. But basically, these two molecules antagonize each other. So every time you think of that event, you've got that tug of war going on with those two molecules. So what happens with the havening is, by doing these stroking movements quite gently, you actually sedate the calcium, and when the calcium, phosphorus is the other one.
Well done, Ree.
Yeah, I got it at last. So when the calcium and the phosphorus are actually antagonising each other, if you sedate the calcium, he's got no one to fight with, and suddenly you can't bring to mind that with the same sort of feelings, the same kind of thoughts about it. So this guy and I did this one round, and I said, okay, what I want you to do now is flick your eyes left, flick your eyes right, flick your eyes left, and then score your event. And he went, 7. And I went, 7,000? He went, no, Annie, 7. He said, I'm finding it quite difficult to bring it to mind. So I said, okay, do you want to go again? So we went again and we got it down to 2. And then we did it again and we got it down to 0. And he said, I really, really can't believe this, and I can't thank you enough for putting up with such a sceptic. And I was like, do you know what, honey? It's absolutely my pleasure.
You're a bit used to the sceptics anyway, aren't you? Not many
of them. I love sceptics.
It does have to be said, as far as I can gather, that you definitely, as we all do, encounter a fair few sceptics, but most of them are not sceptical when they leave us, are they?
No, not at all, darling, really not. And one of my greatest ones is a guy who now, every networking event that I go to, I will say, and I guarantee, if you have a session with me, you will experience heaven sent bliss. And he'll go, shall I do you with the strap line, darling? And I'll say, okay, Jonathan, go for it. And he'll go, it's bollocks, but it works.
That's the way. That's the way. I've got a question here from Nick Nomic, and actually it's a pretty core question, this one, I think, because he says, Doc, first experiences I had of NLP were not good, because folks were just after money or pulling girls. Could Annie comment on how to safely employ this positively? And as he says, there are a fair few folks in here, and I'm one of them, actually, who have a tendency to equate NLP to mainstream manipulation, because that's largely what it's being used for.
You see, because I've not had that experience, I've only ever had really positive experiences. I can't really tell you what it's like to not be getting that, if you understand me. And I don't know how to protect yourself other than to try try it out with somebody. I know that the people that were taught by my teacher, Tony Burdish and Julie French, it's called the AHA Academy. So literally those moments of excellence when you go, aha, I've got it. I don't know because I've never had a negative experience with it, and I don't know how people would use it, because it's outside of my experience, basically.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, I suppose that all of these techniques can be used for one thing or another. I can imagine people going out there and just using it for pulling girls or whatever. There's nothing wrong necessarily with being after the money, though, is there? I know a lot of people whose affirmations are based on that.
No, my own are based on that because, I was brought up in a family that considered anybody who was really rich, they would call them the filthy rich. And I'd got an auntie who was very affluent and, quite rightly, very successful at what she did. And I was told as a child that I didn't want to emulate that. And it was only as an adult that I thought, why not?
Yeah.
Why would I not want lots of money and to be able to do what I want when I want and to be paid really well for doing what I love? And so actually it's been really useful to me as an adult to actually overcome all those really negative messages about being rich. You know, what the actual terminology, filthy rich, really?
Yeah.
Why would you be saying that's the case, when actually I really believe that money's only love? Money's only love. It's just in a different form, basically.
Yes, I was chatting with a chap the other day who was, we were talking about money, and he was saying to me, look, it's it may be, because he was saying it is just the milk of the mother. And I was saying, well, yeah, it'd be nice if it was, but it's not. And he was saying, well, the thing is, that's all kind of like, and he waved his hands up in front of his face and he said, that's all kind of up here. What we need to look at is what it is at root, because that's where the attitudes and everything needs to be sorted.
Yeah, absolutely. Very much so.
And it's very difficult to make any progress without money still. I think the other thing is, the question, about commenting on how to safely employ this positively, that's surely broadly the same thing, isn't it, as whether you're using, for want of a better word, black magic or white magic. It's all the same energy.
Yeah.
And you know when you're trying to influence somebody to their disadvantage and when you're trying to help out. And that's basically the difference between the two things, surely.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. And as you say, intense everything. I'm a practicing white witch, as you know, and I'm just as capable, I'm certain, that I could actually practice black magic if I wanted to. It doesn't interest me, and I think that my positive intentions for everything that I do, you know, to give love and receive love in every single thing that I do, I think if we were all doing that, well, there wouldn't be any issues with people using things to dominate other people or to manipulate them in some way, because once we've learned to love ourselves, we're really not into silly games like that, are we? So.
Nick says, appreciate the honest answer from Annie, and the filthy, stinking rich comment is a great help. When I was looking into NLP, because I am in, the thing is that I am aware that it is being used very, very extensively in schools and government departments and all over the place, and it's being used deliberately to psychologically reframe people, and I've actually seen it happening now. That's one of the reasons why I'm interested in it, is because it's obviously, if somebody's going to be using a bat to be beating you with, it's a good idea to have some understanding of the nature of the bat.
Yeah, now, absolutely.
One of the things that the one thing, in fact, that really stuck with me was this business of being able to tell broadly whether somebody's not always, but broadly, whether somebody's telling you the truth or lying to you. Using what they call a cue chart, where their eyes are looking when they're talking to you.
Well, the thing is, it's how our brains are set up in human beings. So it's typically you look at the person, you need to know what their dominant hand is, because it makes a difference. If you're cue accessing and you're thinking that the person's making this up, not really remembering it, you need to make sure that you know which hand they were using, because actually, if they're a left-hander, then they won't give the same reading as a right-handed person. But cue accessing is about which part of the brain you're accessing to say the information.
Yeah,
sometimes, because when people come for therapy, I've watched where they're looking, because I want to be certain that they're sure where the information's coming from. Is it a real memory, or is it something that they've been told happened? So I'm interested in a therapeutic way of looking which way they're going, because it may be something that they're completely unaware, that they're not actually remembering this event. They're remembering what they've been told about this event, and that's a different way of working. So once I know that, it doesn't matter to me whether it's they've been told the information and they're creating this information from that, or if they're actually remembering it. And if they're actually remembering it, it just means I work in a different way.
Yeah. It is. Am I right in thinking, I'm fishing back into my brain now.
Yes.
If you're right-handed, let's assume you're right-handed.
Yeah.
And you're asked a question and you glance upward and to the right, it's a kind of visual construct. And if you glance upward and to the left, it's visual recall.
Yeah,
so basically, for a right-handed person in that example, and this, I hope I've got this right, if they look upwards and to the right, then they're making it up. And if they look upwards and to the left, or guessing or whatever, and if they look upwards and to the left, then it's an actual recall and they know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
That's broadly what we're talking about, isn't it?
Broadly, but what my teachers told me is that it's only useful in a therapeutic setting, and it shouldn't be used as, like, you know, they'd heard of somebody that was using this as a lie detector with their kids.
Right. How did that work?
Well, dreadfully, really, because this child hadn't actually done it. It was the brother. And so it's not all, you know, it can give you a clue, which is all it's meant to do. It's a cue accessing clue. It's not meant to be written in tablets of stone, and we've all got our own little idiosyncrasies, haven't we? So Tony Burgess was at great pains to say, actually, you know, just remember that it's only one of the tools that you've got available. And when I told him how I was using it, so I can make sure that my patients are getting the best possible therapy for getting rid of a trauma that actually happened, not one that they were told about, that they then, you know, had to construct bits and bobs around it to make it real. It just alters the way I work with them. So he was saying, well, you know, I think the way that you're working with people with this is fine. I'm just a little concerned that sometimes people are saying that this is written in tablets of stone and it's not. It really isn't.
It is going to vary from person to person, but you sound like you find it a useful technique, though.
I do, because I want to give my patients the best possible treatment within the confines of that session so that, you know, they're getting the maximum benefits from what I'm doing. So sometimes it's just helpful to give them information. And I have told patients in the past that I think this was a real event for you. And once they know that, they can acknowledge it and they can start doing something about it with the help of whatever therapy that we're using. Whereas if it's something that, I don't know, let's say your granny told you about a traumatic event, and although you'll have been shocked at the time, it's a different energy completely to you actually experience this as a human being. So it would help with the way that I would actually be able to do the therapy for the particular person. So I think in those circumstances, there is no negative intent.
Right. And how much, I mean, obviously, neuro-linguistic programming obviously is fairly heavily reliant on language and the way language relates to the brain. How much do you find it has changed the way you use language?
Let me just go and get a piece of paper and I'll talk to you about Milton language that I think you'll love.
Go for it. I hope you're enjoying this, folks. Well, we are wrapping up on the NLP shortly, playing a couple of tunes because she's been chatting for an hour or so. And then we'll be moving on to the sexual healing, which is what she's really specialising in now. It scares the willies out of me. Are you back?
I love your phraseology. That was very NLP. That was a beautiful introduction. So this is Milton language. So I'm going to address this love letter to you. Dearest, amazing, awesome Ben, they say that people can learn to be in control of their thoughts, and I have confidence in your very great excellence. And as you continue to notice how often you feel beautiful and are called beautiful by others, the more exciting you will find innovative ways to feel even more beautiful. Back then in the past, you may not have allowed yourself to experience and perceive your very great beauty. And as you are noticing now in this moment how easily and quickly you are very aware of your great beauty, don't think about how easy and exciting noticing your great beauty is going to be. We can come to that later. As a part of you already knows how to accept and feel very beautiful. And I'm not suggesting that you consider the ripple effects that will come with this change or how easily you will find it to change, or indeed how easily you will find it to integrate the energy of great beauty, as we already know that every cell of your body is resonating with great beauty. How great is it to realize that just by giving yourself permission to be beautiful, that this is already happening. You are beautiful and your beautifulness is contagious. So I don't want you to think about how easily and quickly you are really feeling so incredibly beautiful. And isn't it brilliant that just by having a conversation like this can trigger such great and beautiful results? I can see already that you have really integrated the pattern of great beauty into yourself completely. And as for excellence, you will have already noticed how very easily you are stable in this pattern of excellence. And when this procedure succeeds, we know you will keep noticing just how very clever you are at finding new ways of being so successful. And because of this, you quickly inspire yourself to find even more innovative and fun ways to be excellent. And because you are so incredibly resourceful, excellence is becoming your normal habitual pattern. And as you notice how incredibly talented you are at being excellent, the process becomes easier and more deeply embedded. And I'm not saying that you will come through this breakthrough and find it really liberating and life-changing. I certainly don't want you to think about yourself in the future, easily finding the stamina and determination to continue with this excellence. And as you notice how brilliant you feel due to your excellence, give yourself full permission to experience increased energy levels and feelings of great satisfaction at being so excellent and very beautiful. And that was Milton NLP language. And what I've just described to you is a love letter that I often read to my patients. Once I've got them into hypnotherapy state, so I'll have done all the hypnosis stuff to get them into the most relaxed point.
You do hypnosis too?
I bloody do, damn right.
I didn't know that. You keep quiet about that one.
It's part of my NLP toolkit, if you like.
Okay, so what sort of methods do you use to hypnotise people? I was going to play some music there, but you're drawing me off now.
Oh, sorry. Screw up your programme. I do apologise. So what I'd do is I'd make you really relax. So I would say, I'd start by saying, I'd like you to wonderfully lie down now on the couch, close your eyes, and I want you to enjoy this wonderful, relaxing, easy and effortless relaxation. Just really relax into this bed, and you may start noticing that your eyes are becoming so sleepy. You may start noticing that while you're enjoying this wonderful, easy and effortless relaxation, that you start to notice that one hand is lighter than the other and that relaxation is seeping into every pore. Take the word calm and allow it into your body, into the very core of you, deeply relaxing you as you go inside. And one of the best things inside and out is to comfortably allow relaxation into your body. You may notice that your eyes are feeling so relaxed and so sleepy. It's so easy to relax into a peaceful, calm state for you to enjoy this relaxation. And the wonderful thing about feeling so relaxed is you're feeling so good on the inside. Magnificent you is shining with your inner diamond shining out. Just enjoy that wonderful, easy and effortless relaxation and enjoy that feeling on the inside. I'm going to touch your forehead and you will see yourself shining at everything. Everything you touch is successful. Everything you touch turns to gold. And every part of you is enjoying being so pleased, so happy and so successful. Enjoy this feeling that is bringing you so much joy and good stuff coming your way. Wow, look at that wonderful future you're seeing, aren't you? Bring back all those resourceful feelings back to the present moment. And I'd continue like that.
Oh, God, I'm on the radio. Very good. Did you notice that your accent disappeared almost entirely during that?
Did it?
It did, yeah. Yeah. You sounded like you hypnotised yourself. That's really great on the NLP. Thank you very much, Annie. And I shall continue practicing the affirmations and the self-stroking movements. And presumably we'll be getting onto a different sort of self-stroking later.
Oh,
in the meantime, we'll take a 10-minute music break so we can refresh our water glasses, get a breath of fresh air or whatever, before we get onto the subject of Annie turning herself into Dr. Sex. And I'm going to play Robert Plant's Mighty Rearranger because it seems to me to be at least vaguely applicable, and we'll be back with you in 10 minutes or so, folks. Welcome back, one and all. You're listening to Dr. Rock's radio show here on peoplesinternetradio.com, where we're seeking solutions, and tonight we're seeking them with the help of Annie Day. You were just listening there to Fun Loving Criminals and Scooby Snacks, and before that, Jules Holland's Rhythm and Blues Orchestra with Chris Barber and Guy Barker playing Angle Grinder Blues. What a magnificent horn section. I think we'll be getting onto horn sections of a different sort shortly. But before we do that, we were recalling, Annie, that you haven't always been the joyous, bubbly, confident and outgoing lady. And I remember when I first met you, you were telling me a story about how it all started when you changed your name. Would you just like to reprise that for the people?
Yeah, sure. At the time, we were broke all the time. Literally, Terry, my lovely husband, as fast as he earned money, we'd get bills that would wipe them all out. And we were doing lots of affirmations on finances and prosperity and abundance. Our relationship was going down the pan due to a lack of communication and all sorts of other things. And I was very fortunate. I think you've met Deborah Goldstone in the past, haven't you?
Yeah, I have, yeah.
She invited me to come to a workshop on prosperity and abundance. And I got right to the end of it and I said, Debs, I don't understand what's going on. Because most of that stuff I do already. I do all the affirmations. I give 10% of my wealth to my favourite charity. And all the other things you were saying, you know, I'm already engaging with. And I don't get it because this isn't working for me at all. And I'm not, you know, I'm not saying this is a bad workshop. I'm just saying I don't know what else I need. And she said, oh, I do. She said, about 5 years ago, I was a barrister and I was driving up to Manchester. And I happened to hear this man on the radio called Lawrence Page, and he's a name analysis. And this is an Egyptian system that's been used for hundreds and thousands of years, that our names are magical. And basically, every year that you're alive, your name will progress from, you know, the first letter of your first name, then any middle names that you've got, and then your ending name. And she said, at the time when I actually heard him on the radio, I couldn't keep a man for love nor money. Every bit of money I got was running through my fingers. And I was just really unhappy. And she said, I phoned him up and said, you know, can you do a name analysis on me? And he changed her name from Deborah Handley, D-E-B-O-R-A-H, Deborah, to Deborah, D-E-B-R-A, Goldstone. And literally within 3 months of her changing her name, this magical equation of the letters that she just told Lawrence what she wanted for the future. She'd got married. She'd got a really successful complementary therapy practice. She was an international speaker all over the world overnight, a really valued author and all sorts of other funky stuff. And her health had never been so good. So at this point, she'd said that and we both trusted her. So I came back, told Terry, and then, cutting a long story short, he'd said, we'll speak to this guy, and then if we both think that this is a good thing to do, then, you know, we'll have a discussion after he's spoken to both of us, and we'll think about whether we want to go ahead with the name analysis. So literally, I spoke to him for 10 minutes. He told me that with the names that I'd been called at birth, that when I was born, I was dying of some kind of lung condition. And I said, yeah, I was dying of bronchopneumonia when I was born. How do you know that? And he said, oh, just because of the configuration of the letters. My previous name was Anne Catherine Coley. And just from knowing that information, that what my date of birth was, and knowing what the letters of my name are, he could figure out. He knew that I'd had a really bad fall in 1998. And what he said was that if we ordered this name analysis, it would tell us, not only, you know, not only was he accurate from the past, but he would tell us what was likely to happen if we kept our present names and didn't make any changes at all, what was going to happen to us based on this scientific approach. So he told me stuff that nobody knows about me. So I came off the phone and said, OK, Tez, your turn. And literally 10 minutes later, Terry came off the phone and said, I've ordered it. So when the pack came, it was addressed to me, Anne Catherine Coley, Curtis, and Terry's was Terry Leslie Curtis as well. And Terry listened to his CD upstairs and looked at the pack. I went downstairs and did the same. Mine said, in 2.5 years' time, you will be absolutely bankrupt. You won't have a cent to your name and you'll be happier than you've ever been, because you will be with a person who is far more communicative. You will be with someone that enjoys talking about sex and also having lots of sex, and you will never have been so happy. However, this will not be with your present husband.
Right.
Terry runs downstairs and goes, oh, fuck, we need to do something about this. He just listened to his, and he said, in 2.5 years' time, you will be richer than you've ever, ever been before. However, there is a good likelihood that you will need an operation for a heart condition because your wife will no longer be with you. She'll be with somebody who is far more, you know, is far more similar to her. So at that point, he went, I don't want this to happen. And I went, I don't want this to happen either. So we phoned Lawrence and said, OK, then. So we both agreed that we want to move forward in our relationship and with our finances. Oh, and he also said that it was my maiden name of Coley that was bankrupting us just because it was an unusual blend of numbers that was particularly negative.
Right.
So he said, well, if you really want, if you're sure that you really want to stay together, then I'll give you some names that I suggest will bring in what you really want for both of you. And then, you know, we'll take it from there. We'll change your names by deed poll. So he gave us 6 different names and we couldn't make our minds up. We got it down to 3. We'd got Dave, Bradley and Goldie, and we just couldn't make our minds up which to go with. So we phoned him up and he said, sign your name 10 times in all of those names, both of you, and then send it to me and I'll give it to Hazel, my wife, and she'll have a look at it with the goals and achievements and opportunities that you want for the future, and I'll let you know which one it is. So he phoned us up 2 days later and said, okay, you are Mr. and Mrs. Day. So we changed everything that it was in our previous names. And for me, I had quite a difficult childhood, which I'm, you know, I know defined me. We talked about this on Sunday, didn't we? So I know it was meant to be. But it helped me to really have a much better idea of my sense of worth. And it made me really comfortable with being talkative and being vociferous. Everything that changed for me has made me as confident, and people who've known me, you know, prior to my changing my name in 2005 have said, I can't believe how confident you are now. And I can't believe that you don't give a stuff about what anybody thinks about you, which wasn't what I was like prior to changing my name. And I know it sounds bonkers, and it sounds bonkers to me even now, but I just know the results that we've had. So at the time of us changing our name, we owed £10,000, which didn't include either of our car loans and didn't include our mortgage. And in less than 12 months, we'd got a bank account that was in the black. And you've seen how prosperous and abundant we are now without us kind of doing anything about it. So literally, although it sounded like a really bonkers system, this scientific approach to changing your name to a safe name has been really beneficial. Our young son, Richard, also changed his name the same year because he saw what was happening to us and went, I want some of this as well. So we paid for him to have his name analysed. And again, Lawrence gave him about 3 or 4 different names. And he said, well, to be honest, the goals that my parents want are very similar to my own. And so I can't see any point really in my choosing a different name. If Day's come up as one of my options, it makes more sense for us all to be called the same name. And Richard's had the most extraordinary look, if you want to call it that, ever since. So, you know, the proof of the pudding's in the eating, really. And the fact that we were able to reduce our debt from 10,000 to bugger all in a year kind of gives the game away that it works.
Yeah, and also, as is so often the case, he gave you information that you really by rights shouldn't have had, which is the best way of having somebody's bona fides established, I think.
Yeah, I think so as well.
Also, I have heard that the old, I believe it was the old law dictionaries and the old thesauruses or thesauri used to have a breakdown of the influence of each individual letter in our alphabet, and that there's some, I know that Darren Diogi talks about this a bit, there's some beneficial letters and there's some letters that are not beneficial, and the order they turn up in is also important.
Absolutely, so, that's exactly what was happening.
Also, it seems to me I haven't managed to find any of these references. Not that I've looked very hard. I bet somebody out at People's Internet Radio's got one. I'd love to look at one.
If you want Lawrence's number, Lawrence Page is a real expert on all this stuff, and he can tell you all the history of us having names, and also about how long it's been since, you know, it's hundreds and thousands of years that we've known that what we're called has a magical energy, if you like. So I'm sure that I could put you in touch with him without too much difficulty.
It'd be very interesting to have a word with him and to know where his website is, if he's got one.
Yeah. Do you want me to type it into the Skype box now for you?
Yeah, if you type it into the Skype box, then I'll type it into the chat box so people can go and have a look, because we're all well up for name changes, apart from Rich, who says he's not changing his name because he's Rich.
Perfect. That's what my Richard says as well. I'm Rich Dagg.
It does have to be said that your Richard has had a most remarkable kind of series of uncoverings, hasn't he?
Yeah, absolutely, darling, without a doubt. Yeah.
So let's just let you...
Let me just find his number for you.
I'll let you type that in, and then we can start talking about your where it's all taken you, to your newfound specialty and to actually taking on a degree, which, as well as keeping your practice running and learning lots of new things and keeping people chirpy, which is...
Yeah. I've been so blessed with the whole thing, really, beyond measure, really have been.
Well, of course, in the times that I've been coming up to your place, I've not only met you, I've met a lot of your clients, I've met a lot of the people that you work with, and so, unlike the people in the chat box, I've actually seen the results.
Yeah.
And it is a right little haven that you've made up there as well. I was saying the other day, thank you very much, I'll copy that into the chat box in a moment. I was saying the other day that I was down at a 70-acre farm near Carmarthen, where standing in the middle of this meadow, I saw absolutely no insects at all. And I do see bees and hoverflies around the place in some places. I actually saw several different sorts of bee and several different sorts of hoverfly in your garden.
Yeah. Yeah,
and I can only assume that that's something to do with the magic.
Absolutely, and the fact that I work with fairies and angels. I'm doing a degree, a Master of Science degree, but I've also got a foot in the fairy and elemental kingdom, and I have a really good connection with the angelic realm as well. So I think I've got the best of both worlds, or at least it feels like that to me anyway, definitely.
I'd certainly like to have you back on at some point and talk about the fairies and the elementals, because they have crossed Dr. Rock's desk in the form of Sean Kirwan, who took us all out dowsing for gnomes and gave us a great description of how dowsable the wee folk are and how mischievous and naughty they can be. But let's get on to sex, shall we? So you're...
Absolutely my favourite subject.
Like I say, okay, well, I'll just sit back, off you go. So you're doing an MSc in sexual health and healing.
Basically what happened was 5 years ago, a senior lecturer at Staffordshire University came on to one of my colour and therapy courses, so crystal and colour therapy course, and it was life changing. Once you could douse the psychic information she was getting and verifying it, it really changed her life. And we just got on famously together, because she's a senior lecturer in sexual health and I'm into sexual and spiritual healing. So she wanted to know about Tantra, about Taoist lovemaking techniques and all sorts of other interesting stuff. And she phoned me up the one day and said, I've just been talking to the principal of Staffordshire Uni about you. And I went, right. She said, Annie, we want you to come and do a degree, a bespoke degree. And I said, really? And she said, yeah, we want you to do a Master of Science degree at Staffordshire University. And I went, are you sure? And I said, do you not think I'm busy enough, Margaret? And she said, no, I'm sure you could do this. So I said, okay, then let's just imagine for a moment that I do want to do this. How many days in uni would I have to do? Because clearly that'll have an impact on my business. And she said, well, I'd suggest that eventually you'll want to teach consultants, doctors and nurses this, you know, much more helpful stuff. So I'd suggest you do a certificate in medical education for your first year, and then you do the rest of your degree by negotiated learning, which means that you write your learning outcomes, you decide what you want to learn. You decide what you want to teach. And I was like, blimey, that sounds good. So then I asked the, you know, as well as finding out how many days in uni, can you also find out how much it's going to cost? Because my youngest son did a master's degree a few years ago and it was about $3,000. So if I'm doing it, I need to be manifesting the dosh for it now. So she agreed that she'd get back to me the following Friday. She phoned me up and went, Annie Day, we're going out to celebrate. You are doing your degree at Staff's Uni. And I was like, really? So we over lunch, she told me that I'd only have to do 2 days a month in my first year. And after that, I could go into uni far less frequently because all the rest would be done by self-study. So it was basically my responsibility to make sure that I turned up and I did all my assignments, which was, I can't tell you how lovely it was. I'm not very orthodox and I'm not very good at doing what I'm told. So me being given a free rein for what I wanted to teach and what I wanted to learn was superb. So she said, you only have to do 2 days a month and then the rest of it's self-study. And I said, okay, what about the dosh? She said, oh, well, that was even funnier because you said to me, I'm handing it over to the fairies, elementals and angels. If I'm meant to do this, they'll make it really easy. And if they make it really hard, I'm not doing it. It's as simple as that. That will make the decision for me. So she said, you can imagine my surprise when I went downstairs to the finance department of Staff's Uni and said, oh, Annie's such an amazing teacher. She makes really complex information very easily understood. And the lady said, oh, she's already teaching. Where does she teach? And she said, Stafford College. She said, oh, well, in that case, then we have a reciprocal arrangement between Stafford College and Staff's Uni. She doesn't have to pay anything.
Wow.
And I was like, oh, fuck, I've really got to do it then.
It is quite a thing to take on, isn't it? A PhD.
Yeah, absolutely. But you know what? I'm in my last year. And there is still a bit of me that, to be quite honest, Ben, I'm still pinching myself going, am I really doing this? Because it's so exciting. It's so, so wonderful to be able to be teaching other people about, you know, the magic of sexual and spiritual healing. So, yeah, I'm in the fourth year of my master's degree. So at the moment, I'm waiting for ethical approval. Because I've already done a literature review. My research question is, what is the role of complementary therapies in sexual, in individual sexual health and sexuality issues? So my intent is that, having done the literature review and found very little information on the role of comp therapies in this area, which in itself is important because it's proving why I need to do the degree, to be honest.
What about allopathic texts? Is anybody looking at it?
Well, there is a lot of stuff out there that is NHS related, that's allopathic medicine. There's very little on naturopathic medicine, basically, that helps people. So that's what I want to prove, that we need to be the first point of call for people who have any kind of dysfunction or just want to enliven their relationship. So I'm doing a literature review, which I've already done. And then my intention is, I've got 8 therapists who willingly work with sexual health and sexuality issues. They're going to answer a 13-question questionnaire, which we're doing by email, because there's one in Scotland, there's one in Birmingham, there's one in London, there's one in Clifton. So literally all of us are spread out all over the UK. And then after they've filled in the questionnaire for me, I want them to do a semi-structured interview with me, which we'll do by Skype. And then what will probably not be published is, we want to come up with, because we've already discussed this, what's best practice for complementary and alternative medicine therapists who willingly work with sexual health and sexuality issues. So we've got best practice for complementary therapies. So that's what I'm up to at the moment, but I'm just waiting for ethical approval, and then I'll hand in my final dissertation in February 2015.
Mm-hmm. And what sort of issues do you anticipate dealing with?
Oh, everything. I mean, I elected to go to work in the NHS in their flagship, which is Porterbrook Clinic, which is is world famous for their policy on transgendering, which I'm really interested in. But they there, I worked as a sex therapist for 3 months and learned everything that I could about the way that the NHS works with this. And actually, the guy who actually runs Porterbrook Clinic is a famous sexologist, and he does look at complementary medicine. He doesn't just use allopathic medicine. So he said at my interview that he was delighted that at last they'd got a complementary therapist that was willing, you know, to actually come and run the gauntlet, if you like, and work for 3 months. And it was changing for me, because I needed to know sometimes what my patients will have had to endure before they get to me.
And what sort of stuff do they have to endure with the NHS? God,
one of the worst things was a guy who came to me for sex therapy who'd got erectile dysfunction, and they'd wrongly prescribed, because they're not kinesiologists, so they don't test up each individual for what works best. So they'd given him Viagra, and he had a complete sensitivity to it. So, yeah, Friday night he takes his Viagra tablet, and him and his wife had a wonderful time on the Friday night. And then on the Saturday morning, it was very uncomfortable because he still got an erection. And every time that his trousers touched him or the sheet on the bed touched him, he'd got an erection again. And I know it sounds funny, but this guy was distraught. He ended up having 2 weeks off work because it wouldn't subside.
Blimey, was that with one tablet?
One bloody tablet, yeah. And, you know, if I was going to prescribe anything for anybody, I'd check the sensitivity first, because we're all different. We're treated in the NHS like it's a generic treatment, and all of us respond in the same way. It's like, you know, we all go to the doctors and we all get an aspirin. Well, that might not be the right thing for all of us. And then what they did just... this made me cringe, and I tried to kind of hide my horror at what he'd have to endure. But when this didn't work, you know, or at least it worked too well, they then decided that what would be a better idea was if they gave him this injection, and what he would do is he'd get the adrenaline injection and he'd inject the tip of his penis.
Right.
I know, and I was thinking... the last thing that I'd want to do after I've just injected my penis would be to do anything pleasurable. What's that about? It made my eyes water when it's telling me.
And the thing is that presumably, like so many other things, a lot of it's to do, I mean, obviously partly with psychological issues, but a lot of it will boil down to water and food and things like that again, will it?
Absolutely. And the other thing is the overprescribing of statins. We have no need for statins. It's a really big pile of bollocks that we all need statins. Nobody needs statins. And the majority of patients that have found their way to me since I've been at Porterbrook have been men who've got erectile dysfunction problems because they've gone to the doctors with aches and pains, or they've gone with high blood pressure. They've been put on statins. You need high blood pressure for one particular part of your body if you're going to make an erection. Mm-hmm. If you're taking antidepressants, it will stop you getting an erection. If you're taking high blood pressure tablets, if you're taking ramipril or statins, it will stop you getting an erection. It's kind of a no-brainer, really. And as soon as they start to come off them and use herbal remedies instead, their problem goes immediately.
Brilliant. So how many of those conclusions were being reached by the NHS place that you went and did 3 months in?
After I left, a lot of them would be using herbal remedies like ginkgo biloba. They'd be using Siberian ginseng. And they'd be using crystals by making yourself an elixir with ruby and garnet every day. So basically, you clap over the piece of ruby and garnet to make sure they're clean before you make an elixir from it. You get an unmarked glass, best quality water, put your crystal into the glass, leave it on your window ledge for, overnight, drink it the next morning. And what ruby and garnet does is it really improves your circulation. You need to have good circulation if you're going to make an erection.
Yeah.
So after I'd been there for 3 months and I was saying, well, you might want to think about doing blah, 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 blah. And because the clinic actually saw the results I was getting, it was really, again, it's experiential learning. They watched what I did. They modelled that excellence and they started saying, OK, where can I get this information from? How can I help my patients with this? What was good about it was because it's a teaching hospital, all the patients were asked if they were comfortable with actually being televised for at least one of their sessions for training purposes. And so people actually heard exactly what I said. They saw what I did and they saw the results from week to week, because typically patients who were having problems would usually arrive, it could be singly, but usually as couples. And then they would have counselling and sex therapy. And then they would come back for probably 6 weeks and then we'd have a look at how they were progressing and if it was working. And if not, you know, you do something else. And because I was getting such what to them seemed like miraculous results, it really helped them to take it on board very quickly.
That's amazing, isn't it? Well, it does seem to me that your encounters, your intermingling with the NHS does seem to be doing at least a bit of it in staff, so quite a lot of good, really.
Yeah, without a doubt, darling.
But I mean,
and I'm sure it is that it's outside of these people's experience. It's not that they're deliberately not engaging with complementary medicine, it's just that they don't have an understanding of it. And if you don't understand it, you fear it, don't you?
Yeah. I mean, I think that at the same, I mean, did you find that they were open to taking these new, I mean, quite apart from the fact that these techniques are not on their curriculum, as it were, and the things you're recommending are not produced by the pharmaceutical companies who train these people and from where they make the money. I mean, it sounds to me, I mean, just on statins, let alone, and blood pressure, those two things, this must be a really widespread challenge to the medical industry.
Yeah.
And it's a widespread challenge that they're actually causing themselves.
Absolutely. It's craziness, isn't it?
And you're going in there and talking them to it and get about it and getting results without taking a beating off them.
And, you know, I know how to play the system. I've been doing this for a long time. I know that you achieve far more by smiling at people and not being confrontational. I learnt it a long time ago. And I kind of think that, you know, if I treat people how I would like to be approached, then it works. Because if I'm really gentle with people and say, I know this is outside of your understanding and I know it sounds bonkers, but just hear me out about what I need to say. And quite often, if I go in with that approach rather than very confrontational, people actually listen to me, because I'm not a threat then. I'm not attacking them. I'm just saying, you know, you might want to reframe this. You might want to look at this in a different way and maybe get better results than you're getting. And again, using the NLP language really helps with that. We said right at the beginning of the programme that I'm not overtly critical of them. I'm saying, I appreciate with the training that you get, you won't have come across this before. So I'm kind of colluding with them that, you know, it isn't them that's wrong. It's just the training that they get. And that way it makes people much more open-minded to what I'm saying, I think.
Yeah, and presumably most people that are working in these kind of fields do want to get good results.
They do, absolutely. You know, that's why they became sex therapists, because they really want to help people who are having a really tough time, basically. So anything that you can do that's more gentle and more congruent with, you know, with what we need to do, then it's got to be good for the patient, rather than giving them, as you say, lots of pharmaceutical drugs that they can't process.
Do you think that, I mean, in a wider scale, in the long run, I mean, do these people go and, because most doctors seem to think that high blood pressure pills are a good idea, even though they don't know how they work or what's causing the high blood pressure.
Oh, I know.
And yet there seems, even from my brief perusal of it, there seems to be an awful lot of information out there that they could be looking at. Do they go and look at it? Does it make them question their role, actually, or the role of the NHS?
I think that, to be honest, the ones that we've been, the groups of doctors that we work with are very open-minded, because they're second and third year registrars. But I'm sure it's more difficult for more elderly, shall we say, doctors, and doctors that have never ever come across complementary medicine unless they've experienced it. They're very much, you know, kind of groping around in the dark. But I think increasingly, they're literally they're finding it difficult to be able to cope because they want to meet their patients' needs. They want to genuinely, they want to help them. But, you know, one of the things that my patients say to me after they've experienced the NHS is, I look at them the whole time. I make sure I'm very attentive. I make it very plain that I'm interested in them and I genuinely want to help them. But I never let any of my patients start the session without doing 20 minutes consultation at the beginning. My lovely friend Charlotte, who's just resigned as a GP that we've talked about previously, she says you've got 8 minutes to make a diagnosis and have your patient marching out the door. I defy anybody to be able to give an accurate diagnosis 100% of the time with so little information. It can't be done.
Even with kinesiology, you'd be hard-pushed to get enough answers in that time, wouldn't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And what she was saying was that on the computer in front of you, it will be telling you what questions to ask. Thank you. My lovely husband's just brought me a cup of hot water. So, she was saying that there's all these different questions that she's got to tick off on the computer. And she said, for some of my elderly patients, they've said, why don't you ever look at me anymore? And she said, I'm really sorry. I have to tick all these boxes on here to say that I've actually answered all these questions, which is just bonkers, isn't it? That, you know, she said, that isn't what I signed up for. That isn't why I said the Hippocratic Oath. When I said that I wanted to do my patients good and never harm them, I meant just that.
Yeah. So it's, when you set about defining your own course, what sort of main headers were you looking at when you started working that out? What was interesting you?
I was looking at emotional and physical pain and spiritual pain, to be honest. I know it sounds a bit of an arse about face kind of a way of going about it, but I was really interested in the psychological aspect of sex and the emotional bit of sex, because by that time I'd not only had my own experiences of sex, but I'd also got all my families and everybody that I'd ever spoken to and all the patients that had presented themselves to me over the years. So I wanted to find out how people cope with emotional loss and grief issues, how they cope with emotional pain, but how they cope with physical pain. So the first assignment I ever did was on looking at the, while I was working at the hospice, I found a model that said that it's called the total pain model. And what it says is that if you just throw opiates at a pain, it won't work. If you help the person to address their mental state and their emotional state and give them opiates, it'll work beautifully. And I started from that kind of premise, really, that I wanted to know how I could help people psychologically. Because as you said earlier, a lot of sexual problems are to do with what we've experienced and how we're holding on to those things and how they're hurting us. So any way that I could find to help people to address psychological and emotional issues surrounding sex and their sexual spiritual blueprint, I was really interested in. So that was my first assignment. And then the next one I did was on using things like Tantra and Taoist lovemaking techniques. So literally making sure that you're engaging the mind, body and spirit in the act, so it's not just fucking, because that isn't what we need. We are equally spiritual and sexual beings, and actually the physical act needs to be enhanced, if you like, so that all our emotional state, all our body and all our spirituality is actually zinging when we take part in that act. So it becomes a way of connecting with the divine, whatever you might refer to that as.
Yeah, I remember when we do on those ceremonies, it's one of the things it says is that we have the ability to basically attain a spontaneously arising bliss, and that ability has been driven into neuroses, which are, I mean, sexual, fundamentally sexual and economic in nature.
Right.
And I guess these old, the tantra and things like that, they're thousands of years old, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely.
And, I did have a look at one of those books once and shut it again pretty quick. You've got a whole pile of them.
I have got the world supply of very, very erotic books down there and very useful books as well. But, yeah, the tantra's been going for hundreds and thousands of years, but also the Taoists as well have been using sex magic for, you know, millennium, basically. And the teacher that's made it kind of known globally is a guy called Mantak Chia, which is Mantakchia. And basically, he's a Taoist master. And what he recommends for people is that men don't ejaculate, that you use your life force energy when you ejaculate. So some of his book titles that are particularly well known are The Multi-Orgasmic Couple, The Multi-Orgasmic Man, and he does one for women, which is called Cultivating Female Sexual Energy. And they're literally practices that are millions of years old. And he backs it all up with the research and where he found it. But he applies this to our modern dilemma, if you like, to be able to feel that connection to the divine through the act of sex. And what he suggests you do is that you strengthen your PC muscle, which is between your sex and your anus, basically. And just by clenching that muscle can actually mean that you have control over it. And what he suggests is that at the point of orgasm, that you just remember that the kundalini snake that runs from your sex up your frontal plane and right up to your bottom lip, the other part of the kundalini snake is said to wrap around your sacral three times. It goes up the back of your spine, over your head, over your crown, over your third eye, and ends at your top lip. So what he's saying is that just by remembering that we've got that kundalini energy within us like a kundalini snake can make a really massive difference to how we feel after we've made love. So we've actually literally strengthened that cord to the divine.
And it is said, isn't it, these old Taoist techniques and stuff are said to strengthen the endocrine system and also lengthen life.
Yeah, absolutely. There's lots of reports. He's actually based in Thailand, and there's actually reports of people who are like 200 years old, and for them it's not a big deal. You know, they live out in villages, and they would tell you that it's doing sexual practice every day or sexual spiritual practice every day that has done that. And also, one of the most remarkable things that I discovered was that by doing these sexual and spiritual practices, it helps you to stay younger for longer so that you feel more joyful, more energetic. And so when I first came across this was in 98, and I was exploring lots of stuff. But that was one of the things that I discovered. And I have to say, it was life changing for me. I literally come from a Catholic background, which was not particularly helpful, as you can imagine. And and it's perhaps why I'm like I am today, is that I literally learnt a long time ago that wasn't the way for me to operate. So, you know, when I learnt all this, I was absolutely astounded that everybody else didn't know it. And I'd come across something literally that was quite remarkable and quite unique. And when I finish doing this, I'm going to write a book on sexual reflexology, because one of the things that the Taoists know is that you can use sexual reflexology. So if you look at one of your digits and you imagine that's a penis, I know it's not really a very good representation, but, you know.
I don't know, it's not far off.
Perhaps be better with your thumb, I don't know. So look at one of your digits, and if you imagine right where the top of your nail is, that if that was a penis, the heart chakra is at the very top of the penis. Moving down a little bit is the lungs, then the liver, then the digestive system, then the spine. Equally, in the woman, if you turned your finger upside down at the very top of the cervix, that's where the heart chakra is, then the lung, then the liver, digestive system and the spine. So let's say that you and I are a couple and you've got something wrong with your heart and I don't. So literally by us making love in a particular position, that means that my heart gives you and your heart my really fantastic heart energy, could mean that we heal each other just by choosing the position that we're making love in. Well, I don't know about you, but given the choice of going to doctors or making love to sort your heart out, I think I know which one I'd like to choose.
So is that right, is it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Blimey.
I know, so I really want to teach everybody that. So I'm going to, when I finish my degree, obviously, but when I finished it, that's what I'm intending to do, is to write a book and incorporate the research that I've done already when I went to Amsterdam and I interviewed sex workers, because it makes a huge difference if you're legalising prostitution, which I'd like everybody to do. I think that sex workers do a really, really good job for us and that they should be able to work safely. I'd also like to include something on the ladyboys and the shamanic practice of in Thailand of having that third gender, but also the difficulties that ladyboys face as well.
I was going to ask you that because I'm aware that you know, over in that neck of the woods, they do have kind of girls' dormitories, boys' dormitories and dormitories for the in-between. And,
yeah, absolutely.
Jess was telling me that when she was in Nepal, you'd get bus conductors with beards and stuff dressed in a skirt with all the makeup and everything. Yeah. Is it widely accepted over there, or is it just something that, I mean, how do they handle it?
It does seem to be widely accepted out there. And there's been some research done recently that says that, you know, the people in Thailand have always had this third gender. And obviously, you know, in modern times, it's become more, what shall I say, publicised. But shamans were always males dressed as females. That was part of the transvestitism, if you like, was part of their shamanic practice. And it helped them to be really gentle souls and to really engender the divine feminine with the divine masculine. I ended up interviewing seven ladyboys. What happened was, myself, Terry, and my youngest son went on holiday together.
You took your son?
He's an adult male and he's my child. Or no, he's my creation. So he's wired up the same as me. He's very interested in sex. And they agreed that we'd go to Bangkok and I would go to a ladyboys bar and I would pay for their time and I would interview them for my degree. And I was astounded at what really happened, because I got into this bar and the guy came over and said, "What would you like?" And I said, "I don't really want sex. I'd really like to talk to you. I'm doing a degree and I want as much information as possible about what it's like being a ladyboy in a country that, you know, allows the operation, is very, you know, very public about people being able to have you know, all the operations and everything else that goes with being transgendered." And he said, "Is this going to be published?" And I thought, oh, bugger, that's the end of that. So I said, "Darling, it is. It would definitely be published. This will be, you know, this will be published. It will be in the, what shall I say, general public. Anybody will be able to get into this degree, basically, and read my findings." And I thought he was going to say, "Okay, well, you know, we don't have a deal." And he said, "Can you come back at 6 o'clock tomorrow night?" And I said, "Why?" He said, "If you're going to publicise it, then I want six of my friends to come and help me, and I'd like you to interview all of us." And I was like, "Really?" He said, "Yeah, really, Annie, you've no idea what it's like for ladyboys in Thailand. Although we do more operations for transgender than anybody else on the planet, actually, once you've gone through all the total transgendering operations, the Thai government won't then let you change your ID card, your passport, your driving license to reflect your female status. That means that you cannot be employed as a female."
It sounds like an economic move on the part of the Thai government, doesn't it?
It's dreadful. And he said, it's why most of us end up as sex workers, because there's nothing else we can do. And I was so heartbroken, really heartbroken that that's the case, that you can literally go through all that without any counselling, without any help psychologically or emotionally. The criteria is, can you pay for the operation to have your Adam's apple shaved? Can you pay to have the breast implants, or to pay for the female hormones that will help you to grow your breasts? And can you pay for the final, you know, transgendering operation? And that's all they care about. If you've got the money, you can have it done, irrespective of whether that might be the right thing for you, and irrespective of the fact that you may have nobody to support you emotionally and psychologically. I was absolutely so shocked. And we went back the next day and I was talking to them, saying, how easy is it to disclose that you're transgendered? And the one ladyboy pulled his leotard down, stunningly beautiful, exquisitely beautiful, and said, you see this here, when I told my dad that I was transgendered and I was a ladyboy, he came after me with an axe, and literally he'd got a huge scar right the way across his arm. And he said, that's why I always wear, you know, leotards, where I've got like part the arm in, because I don't want people to see it. And she was really upset and said, you know, I'm trained as a complementary therapist, as you are. And, you know, what I want to do most is I want to do massage. I want to do aromatherapy. I want to do all the things that you do. And I'd give anything to be able to do that. But because I can't change my ID card, nobody will employ me.
It does sound literally like an economic gambit, doesn't it? Because that's one of their biggest tourist pulls.
Absolutely. But then to find that the Thai people themselves, I mean, the rest of the world have, you know, quite often have much more lenient. In the UK, it's not like this at all. I've helped three people now through the whole transgendering process, all of them from male to female. And what the NHS does, which, you know, I have to say, I think they've really got this bit right. I really do think we've got it right. Is the first thing they do when you disclose that you want to go for the transgendering operation is that they do a hormone test. So they just check whether you've actually got female hormones or how much testosterone you've got in your system. Because if you've got lots of testosterone, then this is probably not the right thing for you to do. So the three
does that occur a lot? I mean, I'm wondering, I mean, obviously it's a psychological thing, but is there a physical basis to men wanting to become women?
Yeah, the first person that I took was one of my friends. That his wife had died. He was 65 at the time. His wife had died 5 years previously, and he came to me and said, you know, I want to have this transgendering operation. I feel that I've been trapped in this male body all of my life. I'm the youngest of 9 kids. And I think that I'm meant to be a girl. That's all there is to it. And so the first thing we did was we got a catalogue out. We found him some clothes. We found a company that would do wigs. We found a place that would do hair removal. We booked to go and see somebody about putting makeup on. We did all sorts of stuff. But the first thing the NHS did was call him in for this hormone test. And what they found was that he'd got hardly any testosterone in his system. He'd only got female hormones. So all they did then was say, right, we're going to give you female hormones to grow your breasts, which will also shrink your penis as well. And we will send you for counselling once a month, and you have to go. That's the criteria, that you have to go for counselling, because we don't want you to feel abandoned when you're going through differences in, you know, hormone. You know, you'll be going through different stages hormonally. And then what they said to her was that you need to prove to us that you really need to do this. So you've got to live and work as a female for 2 years. And if you can meet all those criteria, you can have the operation. And she did that beautifully. She gave up truck driving, which wasn't really helpful for somebody that was dressed as a female. And she went off and she did beauty therapies and all sorts of stuff. And she told every employer that that was her aim, that her name was now Jane and not Harry, and that she was female. And after the 2 years, they did the operation on the NHS, the full operation. And I have to say, I've never seen anybody so happy.
I'm astonished, actually. It's really great to hear the NHS kind of approaching something with such a wholesome, a wholehearted approach. I guess there's got to be an exception that proves the rule, eh?
Absolutely.
What about the counselling? Did they leave this individual to find their own counsellor?
Yeah, they could go anywhere, but they just wanted to make sure that they were getting what they needed, basically. So he could choose anybody he wanted. And because I'd got a counselling degree at the time, he said, well, you know, the person that's supporting me through this process is Annie. So is it all right if I do that, or does it need to be somebody that I don't know? And they said, it's up to you. As long as as long as Annie will sign a sheet that will say that once a month she's going to be talking to you and counselling you and giving you the emotional, psychological support that you will need throughout these 2 years, then that's all we care about, that you're getting your needs addressed. And as I say, I really think the UK has got this right. I really do.
It's amazing. I've met several men who either dress as women, want to be women. I've met a couple who've become women. I don't think I've ever met a woman who wants to be a man.
Oh, well, I've met a couple while I was at Porterbrook. And equally, the same criteria would be applied, that, you know, that you go and have a hormonal test first to check that you've got how much testosterone you've got in your system, but also how little female hormones you've got. And then the same thing would be, you've got to make sure that you're getting counselling on a regular basis, at least once a month. And then, you know, you need to live and work as a man for 2 years, and then the NHS will do the operation for you. So I've seen that happen. And actually, the two women that I worked with that wanted to be men, actually, when you looked at them, they, for all intents and purposes, although they hadn't got the right...
tackle.
Yeah. They, for all intents and purposes, the way they spoke, the way they walked was more manly than feminine, and they just looked far more masculine without that being, you know, a negative.
And was there a kind of hormonal basis to that as well?
Yeah, absolutely. They'd got lots of testosterone and no, or very little female hormones in their system.
It's amazing, the hormonal system, isn't it? Because men and women have the same endocrine system, but they turn, and they even turn out to a certain extent the same hormones, but in different proportions. And that's fundamentally the difference between us, isn't it? Is these little chemical messenger molecules.
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, that's amazing. And what about other people? I mean, most people I know are pretty sympathetic to this sort of thing and treat such people just as ordinary individuals, which really in every sense they are. Did they find, you know, and you can see why the NHS wanted them to be out there working under the as the opposite gender. How easy did they find that? I mean...
They thought that for all the five people that I knew really intimately that were going through this, the two females that want to be males and the three males that want to be female, they had more difficulty with their own family than they did with complete strangers. So literally they'd go and get a job and say, I need you to know that I'm, you know, that I've changed my name from, let's say, Harry to Jane, and I am going through the transgendering process. They found on the whole that their new employers were absolutely wonderful about it, because they were honest and because they looked vulnerable and they needed help. But unfortunately, three of the men that were changing to women, perhaps because they were all elderly, they were beyond 60, their siblings just couldn't cope with it at all.
Really? Wow, that's a late time of life to be going for that.
But you know what? Doesn't it prove that they really needed to do it? If you have waited 65 years, which that was what Harry did, to actually go through this, how important must this be to you that you've waited all this time and you're still prepared to do it? Mm-hmm. Because whatever few years you may or may not have, you want to be as happy as possible. I think it's just dreadfully important that that's the case. But because their relatives were of that age group, they were just, well, they were very, very unkind, to say the least. Mm.
So, I mean, yeah, they presumably were saying things like what Mahatma's saying in the chat room here. You know, the reality is, if you're born a male, you're a man, and if you're born a female, you're a woman.
Yeah.
You know, what would you say to that kind of, because that can't be an uncommon approach. Main admin said bollocks. Thanks, Laurie.
Well, yeah, I suppose, again, I don't come across anybody who's unkind about transgender people. And I suppose one of the things I help people with is coming out the closet about being transgendered or being gay or being bisexual. And again, often it's our families of origin that have the most difficulty with us, not people beyond our immediate family that seem to...
I think is it perhaps because they feel kind of responsible for us and what we are, and that somehow it reflects on them?
Yeah, I suspect so. You know, there was always that thing years ago. I remember on a loo wall, I went in the male loo by accident. There was a big queue in the female one, and I thought, I'll go to this other loo, and it wasn't. It was a male loo. And on the loo door, it said, my mum made me a pufta, and some other lovely person underneath the put, if I give her the wool, will she knit me one?
Oh, I don't know.
So I'm sure that kind of, you know, unhelpful betrayal of how it happens, it has not been helpful to anybody who's transvestite, transgendered, gay, bisexual, I don't know, you know, whatever floats our boat. It's not helpful to be criticised for it by your own family, clearly. And, yeah. And I suspect that people do feel responsible for it.
Yeah. So we've probably got about 10 minutes of talky left, because we'll play out with a bit of music and we can have a bit of chat. What did you discover when you were over in Amsterdam talking to these sex workers, where it's like so many other things in Amsterdam, it's a lot more open than it is here? What struck you as the differences?
Well, I was really fortunate, because my intention was that I was going to interview 6 sex workers from the red light district. And I came across, again, the universe is very good to me. I came across the Sex Workers Museum and met a lovely lady called Marissa Major.
A sex museum?
Yes, a sex museum. And it was a sex workers museum. And what I read outside the museum was that she'd been a prostitute or a sex worker since she was 16 by choice, that she now owned a quarter of the red light district. She runs a charity called Bell, which is Respect for Sex Workers Globally. And she also runs the Prostitute Information Centre. So whichever country you work in, she knows what the rules and regulations and the laws are governing your country. So anybody who gets into trouble, they can make a call to her and she'll give you the information straight away. And the day I met her, I'll be honest with you, I really cried when I read her statement on that front window, saying that she thought there was space in the world for people who were sex workers, because genuinely they were giving people what they couldn't get at home, basically. And what she disclosed to me was that she put herself through her own PhD with the money that she made from sex work, and now that she owns a quarter of the red light district, soon to be a bit more, all the girls that work for her are self-employed, and all of them, she sends them on a counselling course before they become sex workers, because she says that most people that come to sex workers need to be heard, they need to be listened to, and they need to be heard, and the sex is secondary to that they want to feel special for somebody, and even if they have to pay for it, that's all well and good. And I was really, really delighted to hear that, if I'm honest about it, because I've thought that for a long time. I've had several men who've told me about their addiction to sex workers, and they've said, well, what she does is she listens to me. She really listens to what I'm saying, and then we have great sex afterwards. And I suspect that that is what most of us need. We need to be heard and we need to be loved.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm thinking that, I mean, it's said to be the oldest profession, isn't it? And I find myself...
Yeah, why are we making such a fuss about it, for goodness sake?
And why is it why is it necessary as well? Why aren't people getting what they need at home? Is it simply a matter of listening? Do we really have actually some kind of well-embedded, deep-seated psychological or conditioned problems, you know? Because it's widespread throughout the world. Presumably it's more common in some places than other, but it seems to be a massive industry. And yeah, really, we're built to do it for each other, aren't we? At home, absolutely, you know.
But, you know, there's lots of sexual surrogates throughout the world. And I know this is kind of, you know, branching off a little bit. But, you know, there's a lady that died early this year, and one of my friends who knows I'm doing a sex degree got in touch with me and said, I thought you would be interested in this, Sunny Day. And this lady had literally helped so many handicapped people, so many people who are paraplegics who couldn't have sex in the normal way. And she would be their sexual surrogate, which again is a form of sex working. And literally there were so many testimonials and affirmations for this woman that had sex with all these people who wouldn't normally be able to have a sexual relationship. And they were all saying how wonderful it was to feel loved by somebody and accepted. So I'm sure there is a place for it in the world today, for so many people. And I spoke to the chief of police in Amsterdam, and he said that he actually thought that there was less crime in the Netherlands of a sexual nature because there was this very healthy attitude to you being able to go to a sex worker. It was no big deal. And although Amsterdam is kind of held up as the one place, it's the same throughout the Netherlands, as is cannabinoid use, which, again, I'm sure makes a huge difference. What Marissa Major told me was that if in Amsterdam you call the set the alarm off, they will guarantee that a policeman will be with you within 3 minutes. And there's also a rat run at the back of the red light district so you can get through and go to a safe house. If you do that in the UK, you'll be prosecuted. Never mind, you know, somebody coming out and respectfully taking care of you and stopping the person abusing you, they'll actually be locking you up and say you're committing a crime. And I can't believe that that's the right way to manage this.
Well,
this is the artist profession, isn't it?
Yeah, and well, we have a problem with the way we handle rape as well, don't we?
Oh, absolutely. There was somebody on Facebook yesterday, and it was shared by my NLP teacher, Tony Burgess. And it was a girl sat on a bench and you didn't see her face, but she got a placard saying, nobody asked my rapist what he was wearing when he did it.
Bad point.
You know, and it really does kind of highlight that we've got so many double standards about, you know, the abuse of power, basically. It's really, you know, it's really shocking to see, but it's unfortunately the world we live in, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. So once you've got your PhD, as well as writing your book,
yeah,
how do you see you taking it forward once you've got the letters after your name and stuff? What's your where are you going next with it?
Oh, I really want an integrative practice so that we've got all types of therapies that do acupuncture, that do NLP, that do, you know, the whole range of complementary medicine, and that we help people with everything basically, but particularly sexual and spiritual healing, because I think that we've kind of had this attitude that our sexuality is bolt on, bolt off. The elderly people and infirm people don't need sex. That's rubbish. And that there is any time in our lives when we don't need to feel really good about ourselves. And so a lot of the things I say to people publicly, I've been asked to talk about sex before, is that I think it's really important that you self-pleasure every day. And quite often people have gone, really? I thought you're married. And I've gone, yeah, I'm married.
There's you recommending it as a daily practice. And, of course, we use it as a term of abuse. And I noticed also, you know, in closing, that that, and I've noticed it before, that with you the words sexual and spiritual come together, and I'm wondering whether part of the problem in the Western world, or, you know, actually wherever Catholicism has gone, really, is that we regard the body as a kind of piece of disposable fabric that really isn't worth our attention, and all of our our intent is encouraged to be on some sort of nominal future up on a cloud with a geezer with a beard and a bunch of guys playing harps where there's nowhere to plug the amps. And
absolutely,
it just seems to me that from that basic idea, you've ended up with a bunch of people who just seem to have had the means of getting on removed effectively.
Yeah, absolutely. And it just seems completely ludicrous to me that we could have ever been taught that sex was dirty, it was shameful. You know, just I refuse to use the word masturbation. I'm only saying it now to prove a point. But, you know, that conjures up the old paradigm, the Victorian paradigm, when we believed that it was shameful to have sex. We believed that we should feel guilty about it, that we weren't allowed to touch ourselves, that we weren't allowed to enjoy ourselves. And we certainly, it would make you blind at the very least. And all of that really needs to change. We need to call it what it is. It's self-cultivation or self-pleasuring. We shouldn't be using language that denigrates something that is our sacred divine blueprint. We are designed to be sexual and spiritual beings. We weren't designed to be shameful beings at all.
That's absolutely excellent, Annie. That is, I think that's a very, very good place to say thank you very much for being on and talking about this. You certainly put the wind up Laurie, the main admin in the site. She was what did she say? She put, do I have a right to a disclaimer for this part of the show? But there's
say not, I'm saying.
I said, can I have one too? But it was a very lovely talk. And I'd love to have you on again at some point to talk about the seashells and the fairies, just to restore your bloody reputation, if nothing else. So it's a big thank you to me for being on. Stay on the line. I'm going to play Don't Touch Me There by the Tubes, because that's pretty much my attitude to the whole thing. We'll have a quick chat and I'll be back to you folks before the end of the show. But here's the Tubes. That was I Know a Little About Love by Leonard Skinner. Feck, do I? Well, big thanks to Annie Day for coming on and talking about that. I don't suppose there's been a lot of that, even on alternative radio. We'll keep track of what she's doing. I will probably be seeing more of Annie as time goes by. And like I say, hopefully next time we get a dowser on and Serena Roney Dougal talking about her love of fairy lore, we'll get Annie to come on and give us her opinion about fairies and her naughty fairy workshops. I don't suppose you want to imagine what's going on there. So thanks to People's Internet Radio for letting Dr. Rock's radio show come on here and do that sort of stuff. Thanks to Laurie for not chucking us off the air for fear of I don't know what. And and thanks to all of you for being out there. I'll be back with you next week with something or other from somewhere or other. Until then, it honestly is a real privilege being here talking to you. I appreciate all of you and look forward to seeing you all again soon. And we're going to finish up with Highway Soldier from Trans Global Underground. Everyone is one with one love, and one love is one with everyone. Too right. See you soon, folks.